From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Anthony Ray Hinton was only 29 years old when he found himself on death row in Alabama after being convicted of multiple murders and an attempted murder. The problem was that he was innocent. Nearly 30 years later, Hinton was finally released after tireless work by lawyers with the Equal Justice Initiative. Now he has written a book about what he went through. It's called The Sun Does Shine, How I Found Life and Freedom on Death Row. In it, Hinton explains not just what happened to him and how he endured his decades of wrongful imprisonment, but how the factors of race and poverty within the criminal justice system created a situation akin to lynching. I had the opportunity to meet Anthony Ray Hinton in person during his book tour, and we spoke about his experience. Welcome to the program, Anthony Ray Hinton.
Thank you for having me.
So you were only 29 when you found yourself accused of crimes you did not commit, and you went through the motions of the criminal justice system, assuming that it would vindicate you. When you were first arrested for these murders and one attempted murder, were you pretty convinced that it would all be over very soon?
I did. All my life I've been taught that justice will prevail. And my mom always told me, if you haven't done anything, you have no reason to lie. You have no reason to run. And I knew I hadn't done anything. And so the last word I spoke to my mother, I said, Mom, we'll go down to the jail and get all this straightened up, and I'll be back in about an hour or so. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly how I felt. I felt that once we get down and find out what all this was about, I tell them where I was or whatever, they'd do whatever they needed to do, and I would go back home.
You were just mowing your lawn when you were arrested?
Yes, cutting grass like I normally do, not thinking that today would be the day that I goes to jail for 30 years.
What was your situation? You were 29. You were living at home with your mother. Your mother, you write in your book, was your best friend. You did everything with her. You had a job. And so you just had your whole life ahead of you at that moment.
I did. I enjoyed, my mother and I made somewhat of a trade. My mother couldn't drive, and she needed a way to go back and forth to the doctor. And I had a way of saving money by living with my mother, and I had the best cook in the world. And like any good mother, you know, she always wanted to be the one that make your bed and iron your clothes. Hey, okay, this is great.
She took care of you.
Absolutely. And so, whenever my mother needed anything or to go anywhere, you know, I was there to take her, whether it's to the doctor, fishing, or visit some of her friends. So, I lived at my mother because we had this relationship where we could live together and love one another. And I couldn't think of a better person to spend all my life with than my mother.
So you were snatched from her. You were snatched from your community. And you didn't come home that day. You spent a good almost a year and a half before you finally had your day in court. You went through the motions. You did a polygraph test. In fact, you've published the record of that polygraph test in your book. And in that polygraph test, you just spoke the truth and you passed the polygraph test. What happened to that test?
Well, FBI agent gave me that test, and my mother had to pay $350 for that test. And I didn't know when they was going to give it. In fact, I was laying up in the county jail, and about 11 or 12 o'clock before midnight, they said, you need to get dressed and go downstairs. And there was the polygraph examiner, and he told me what to do and just answered the question yes or no. And I had no reason to lie again. And whatever he asked me, I said yes and no. And when I got through with it, I never will forget, one of the lieutenants was on, and she asked him, she said, how did he do? And he said, if I could go by this polygraph test, I'd take him out of this jail tonight. He don't know a thing about Doak's murder. And so that made me even feel a little better. And finally, somebody was believing me. But the prosecution had made an agreement that if I fail, he was going to use it. And if I pass, I could use it. When he learned that I passed, he reneged on the deal and said that it was inadmissible in court, and the judge didn't allow it to be. The jury had never heard about it.
And you had some bailiffs testify that you lied about it, that you had found a way to rig the tests?
Yes. I don't know. They already had found me guilty of capital murder. And why they would get up there and lie is unbelievable. Because normally you have someone that live in a cell with you would come up and lie and snitch on you. But for two bailiffs to get up and lie after I've been convicted of capital murder was just another insult to the justice system, that I told them that I knew how to pass a polygraph test. Never told them anything. I didn't talk to the bailiff. But that's what they did.
So usually in a murder case, the critical aspect of any evidence is the murder weapon. In this case, there was a gun used to kill two shopkeepers and the attempted murder of a third. You were meanwhile locked in a secured facility, working a night shift cleaning up and far away from where the murders occurred. And they used an old gun that they found in your mother's house to link you to these murders. How did they use a gun that clearly was not associated with these murders to say you are the one who did it using that gun?
Well, the fact that I didn't have the money to afford a decent attorney is the beginning. And not having the money to hire a qualified ballistic expert was the sentence to death. The lawyer that I had went out and just got anyone, and he got a civil engineer who was blinded in one eye. And with the state having the expert that they had, the prosecution chewed my ballistic expert up. And he made him, when I say they crucified him on the stand. And I often tell people, to be honest with you, had I been on that jury and listen at the two experts, I would have found me guilty. Because you go by the expert. My expert was no expert at all. And what I can't understand to this day is how any judge qualified him to be an expert. He didn't never go to school. Then they talk about the judge. Once judge said, well, he get magazines and he know more than the average human. And so my reply to that was, are you telling me if I get medical magazine through the mail, then I can go out there and have open heart surgery to someone? But it was, you know.
Wow. So they used a gun that hadn't been fired in over 25 years to link you to several murders that had just been committed. But you point out in your book that the prosecutor was out to get you. Tell us about this man.
Well, Bob McGregor was one of the most racist prosecutors that I've ever heard of. And I didn't know he was so bad until I got Brian Stevenson.
This is your attorney who wrote the foreword to your book.
In 2005. And he did an extensive background check on Bob McGregor and the police. Come to find out, Bob McGregor didn't have any love for black people. And Bob McGregor was quoted as saying that he felt that the world should be like Hitler, predominantly white. And he had a profound hatred for me because I stared him down. We was looking at each other.
In the courtroom?
Yes. And anytime a prosecutor say if he ever get out, he said he was going to buy a brand new 38 pistol. And he was going to shoot me down once I walked off the prison ground.
So I'm wondering if you can read for our audience from your book. This is a section when you're in the courtroom. It's been about a year and a half. You've been imprisoned and you finally get to have your say in court and you get to address the judge. You get to address the prosecutor.
Yes. Start off with judge. My attorney began. Let me make aware to this court that Mr. Hinton has requested the opportunity to testify. I have no particular idea of the subject matter of testimony, so there's no way of questioning him. I don't see how it could make any difference if he just testified. And I said, he didn't know the subject matter. The subject matter was the court just convicted me of two cold-blooded murder without any evidence. The subject matter is my attorney just let them find me guilty of two capital offense based on a third attempt murder that happened while I was at work. The subject matter was my attorney hired a ballistic expert who could hardly see and who was crucified on the stand. The subject matter was the state of Alabama wanted to scrap me to Yellow Mama and murder me for a crime I didn't commit. The subject matter was somebody was trying to kill me and I was fighting for my life. That was the subject matter. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and said the same prayer I had prayed in my head 1,000 times. Dear God, let them know the truth of things. Let them see into my heart, my mind, and find the truth. Bless the judge, bless the DA, bless the victim family who are in pain. Dear God, let there be justice, real justice. First of all, I did not kill anyone. It is important for me that the family knows that I didn't kill your loved one. Believe this. I wouldn't want anyone to take the life of someone I love. I couldn't even imagine that pain. I know what it is like not to have a father, to be brought up with that missing in your life, and I wouldn't cause it to anyone. This is a man up above who knows I didn't do it, and one day I may not be here, but he's going to show you that I didn't do it. I wouldn't dare ever think about killing because I can't give a life, and therefore I don't have the right to take a life. I could hear my voice shaking a little, so I took a deep breath, and I looked directly at the widow of John Davis. And if the family satisfied that they got the right man, I'm sorry, but if you really want your husband killer to be brought to justice, get on your knees and pray to God about it, because I didn't do it. I looked up at Judge Garrett. Do with me what seems good to you, but as sure you put me to death, you bring innocent blood upon your hand. I love all people. I never been prejudiced in my life. I went to school and I got along with everybody. Never even been in a fight. I am not a violent person. My mama was nodding, smiling at me like I was in school playing or giving the recital. I kept going. I've been praying to God for the DA, for the judge, and especially the victim. You got to give an account for what you've done. And it don't matter to me because I recall Jesus was prosecuted, accused falsely for things he didn't do. And all he did was try to love and save this world. And he died and suffered. If I have to die for something I didn't do, so be it. My life is not in this judge's hand. My life is not in your hand, but it is in God's hand. I spoke to the bailiff who had just lied on the stand. I told them that I would pray for the Lord to forgive them. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. You all sent an innocent man to prison. You kept an innocent man locked up for 2 years. And I begged, I pleaded with you to give me anything that you believe in. True serum, hypnosis, anything. I had nothing to hide. And I saw McGregor shake his head and roll his eyes and then give a half snort and laughed.
My guest is Anthony Ray Hinton. If you're just tuning in, reading from his book, The Sun Does Shine, How I Found Life and Freedom on Death Row. And that was your testimony in court. McGregor was the prosecutor that haunted you while you were in prison. So that was just under 2 years after you were first arrested. And somehow you kept your faith year after year after year, but 30 years went by. And that story of what happened, you tell in your book, the story of the appeal is an important one. And then the story of how the Equal Justice Initiative finally found you. I want to ask you about how you navigated this labyrinthine system from inside prison walls. Did anybody give you the legal advice you needed? Did anybody help you come up with the inordinate amounts of money that you need to actually hire a lawyer once your court-appointed lawyer basically is done?
No. In the state of Alabama, once you go through, after you've been convicted, your lawyer's still on your case long until your first appeal, and that is through the Alabama Criminal Court Appeal. And after it ran out, he got off the case because the state of Alabama no longer paying. And I sit there for years without a lawyer, and Brian Stevenson, who monitored all death penalty cases in Alabama, sent a lawyer, got a lawyer out of Boston to come down and ask him to represent me in my appeal process. For 3 years, this lawyer from Boston worked on my case, and going into the fourth year, he told me that he was trying to get me a life without parole. And I told him life without parole is for guilty people, not innocent people. And I also told him that I would prefer to die than to plead guilty to something that I didn't do. And me and him didn't get along, and I wrote Mr. Stevenson and asked him would he consider becoming my lawyer, and he did in 2005. And so from 2005 up to 2015, but no one sent me a lawyer. No one gave me any money to hire. Mr. Stevenson owns a nonprofit organization who they do legal work and try to help the poor or the poor in criminal case, and that's how I got out.
Let's talk about the support system that you did have while you were in prison, and not everybody has this. Your mother kept her faith, and you had a good friend from childhood, Lester Bailey, who visited you without fail. How critical was that to your sanity?
Oh, it was beyond what I needed. You know, there's an old saying that God always have a ram in the bush for you, and Lester Bailey was my ram in the bush. Mm-hmm. Who thought? At the age of four and I was sick, we were just two kids running around playing barefooted, and who knew life would bring us even closer years later. And for 30 years, he came every month to see me. No matter how high gas was, no matter how late he had to work, he made sure that he came to see me. And it gave me a sense of a hope as well, that I had someone believe in me. I had someone that was going to beat up for me when the world perhaps said he'd been found guilty and everybody else disbelieved me. He believed in me. And you don't find those type of friendship anymore in this day and age. And so I was just blessed and thankful to have a loving mother that stood by my side and a best friend that stayed by my side.
Your mother had taken care of you before you went to prison. Once you were imprisoned and trying to make sense of why you were in there for a crime you didn't commit, you had to protect her from the awfulness of what was being done to her son. How did you do that?
I just always tried to get her to believe that I was coming home. They was working on it. And every time I called, she would just ask me one question. When are they going to let you come home? And I said, Mama, they're working on it. It's going to take a little while, but they're going to let me come home. They just want to make sure. And I just kept telling her that lie. And 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, up until she passed. And that is what really tears me apart, that my mom was not there the day that I walked out a free man. And I think about how they didn't just take 30 years from me. They took the years away from me that I could have spent with my mom. And I felt, although at no fault of my own, when my mother was sick, I wanted to be the one that give her some water. I wanted to be the one that go in there and make her some soup. But I wasn't able to do that because of where I was at. And I often think, did my mom finally die of a broken heart? And so we need to be very careful when we sentence someone to death, because you don't only just sentence that person. You sentence the person that loved you and care about you. And I may not have had a whole lot of things in this world, but I was born to a mother who loved me unconditionally. And I'm proud to say that. And I'm proud to say that I love my mother.
The scene that you read for us just a few minutes ago of the testimony you gave in court, right after that, they sentenced you to death. You write that that felt like a lynching. Can you tell me a little bit more about seeing the sea of white faces in this court that had already judged you even before the case was over as being guilty?
Well, it was a lynching. Two white men came to arrest me. One white man sentenced me. One white man prosecuted me. A white jury convicted me. It was nothing but a lynching. Everything was white. Even the inside of the courtroom was white. And I just sit there and looked. And I'm saying, this is a way of lynching, but it's just a better way.
And civilized looking.
Well, yes. You know, I often tell people, they brought the tree from the outside and they made a gun out of the tree. It's still lynching. And that day, for the first time in my life, I really felt that this has been a lynching from the whole time. No blacks nowhere, no blacks on the jury, no blacks police officers, no blacks on the prosecution team, nothing but a lynching. And when I had a final say-so, and my lawyer said he don't know what subject matter, I knew exactly what subject matter was. And even my lawyer, I feel to this day, played a part in that lynching. And so everything was white. And I just don't think that I can call it anything but what it was. And that was a lynching.
Your time at Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama, you were on death row. The proximity of your location to death row sounded from your book like in and of itself a torture, that the men that you got to know one by one were sent to their death right almost at your doorstep.
There was, and not only that, I got to know men there that you become family. Because at the end of the day, that's who you with every day, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So you become not just death row inmates, you become a family. And after you get to know these men and get to know their story, if you got any kind of heart, your heart bleeds for them as well. And it's like watching one of your family members being escorted to the death chamber. And about an hour, 2 hours later, you smell their flesh burning. And you sit there. And I had to wonder, did we get it right? Did we get it wrong? But does it really matter? They accused this man of killing someone. Now the state is killing. Who is really the murderer? And so I had to do it 54 times.
54 men went by you to their deaths.
54 men went by myself through their death. And you hear them holler. All you can say is keep your head up. You're praying and hoping that they'll get them a stay. But deep down inside of you, you know they're not going to get a stay. And you go back and you have to put yourself in that same predicament. How would I be? And I've always said, if that day had came, I didn't want my mother to be there to witness her son being executed. And we used to bang on the bars, and that was a signal to the man that was being executed that, hey, we're still here for you. We don't know who back there, but we want you to know if ain't no one back there with you, we're going to beat on the bars until we can't beat no more. And that was a signal to them that we love you, we're going to miss you, and we'll never forget you. And I don't forget the men that went to death while I was there.
Do you feel that we as a society use these euphemisms for the death penalty that obscure what it really is? We say execution, we say capital punishment, we say death sentence, but we don't say murder or killing.
Yes, that's what we do. I mean, every state that has a death penalty, the prosecution, the politician will tell you or try to have you to believe that the death penalty is a deterrent. They lying to you. The moment that Alabama or any other state is killing someone, and I use the word killing, because that's exactly what they're doing. The moment they're killing someone, it's still someone is outside killing someone. And so if the death penalty was a deterrent, why do we still have the senseless killing? On the death certificate that I got a chance to see, the death certificate read murder. The coroner could not put execution. He could not put anything but what caused it. It was a murder. And in any murder, there should be an investigation. But the state feel that they have the authority to murder someone. And we as a society, we allow them to murder them in our name. So we just as guilty.
Do you feel that of the 54 men that walked by you to their deaths, there were innocent men like you among them?
I really do. I won't call one particular guy, I truly believe, but it didn't matter. And just like it didn't matter with the state about me. Had I not been able to get, and God sent me his best attorney, Brian Stevenson, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. And no one is going to his research, and no one is going to spend money to see was that person actually guilty. When you're dead, that's the end of it. Another chapter, next case. And no lawyer's going to keep working on that case if you're deceased. Your family member's not going to try to prove your innocence because it takes money to prove people innocent. And so once we execute someone, the world think they executed a killer last night. Just as I tell people, I was found guilty by a jury. I went through the false of impersonating but having a fair trial, and they got it wrong. I was the 152nd man that had been let off death row. My question is, how many men and women need to be exonerated in this country before we realize we don't need a death penalty? Because it don't solve anything. It's not a deterrent to anything. It's just the politician way of living out a dream of just being able to kill.
Tough on crime.
Yes. Tough on crime. Nothing truth about it. I would love to be able to have a law that says, I would love for it to been able to say, Mr. Hinton spent 30 years in prison. He proved in 30 years that he was innocent. Now, since you lied to the jury, since you said he was guilty and you knew he wasn't, now we're going to put you on death row for 30 years. I wonder how many cases the prosecutor would prosecute. I mean, there's got to be a check and a balance in this country. You know, we get it wrong.
Your book is so brutally honest about the things that went through your head when you were in prison on death row. There was one particular passage that stood out at me for how viscerally you imagined wringing the neck of the man who put you behind bars, the prosecutor. I thought that was really important because even though you went in not being a murderer, you contemplated murder for the injustice that was done to you.
Yes, I won't lie, and I didn't lie in the book. For 3 years, I was in this dog hole, and all I could think about, I didn't want to escape to be on the run. I wanted to escape just to choke the life. I didn't want a gun. I didn't want a knife. I wanted to choke the life out of this human being. Bob McGregor. I wanted my face to be the last face that he seen before he closed his eyes. And that's how much hate I had for him. And to know that a man that's supposed to uphold justice and law would lie because of his own hatred for another man and put innocent people on death row, I felt at that moment that the human side of me wanted to kill him. Yes, if I could have got the chance, I would have just choked the life out of him. I won't lie to you.
You were angry.
No, I don't even think anger is the word. Not only was I angry at Bob McGregor, I was angry at God. I was angry at the system. I was angry. You know, how does an innocent man goes to a place like this and knowing that he haven't done anything and you're supposed to be okay with it? I had to somehow find a way to deal with it because for those 3 years, I was in total darkness. And if it wasn't for that darkness, I don't have no doubt I would have probably hung myself. That darkness saved me because all I could think about was staying alive, hoping I could get away just to go back and strangle Bob McGregor.
So your anger helped you stay alive?
Yes. As weird as it sounds, that's what kept me alive. For 3 years, I often say this, if I had came out of that darkness well before those 3 years, I have no doubt I would have hung myself because this is a place where you don't have hope. This is a place where they send you to die. But that darkness, day, night, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, all I could say, Lord, please find a way that I can escape where I can kill Bob McGregor. and it kept me alive.
You also contemplated escaping or trying to escape the prison.
Yes. I had looked. I mean, every time they would take me to the infirmary, every time I would get a chance to go out on the yard, I was looking to see if there's a way to get.
The justice system had proven to you that it wasn't going to work for yes, you.
Absolutely. And so I was going to do what I needed to do. And as again, I wanted to come out. I wanted to find where Bart McGregor lived or go in their courthouse and choke him right there. And then they could have shot me. They could have kept me back, whatever. But I felt that Bart McGregor deserved it to die. And if that hatred that I had, the human side of me, in that dark place, that's all I could think about.
So your case, you appealed it to the state Supreme Court, and it finally went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is something that very few death row inmates ever get that chance, right?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody goes to the United States Supreme Court at some time, but they refuse to hear their case. My case had lingered in the state of Alabama for about 27 years. That is unheard of. The average stay, I think, on Alabama death row is about 15 years. And for whatever reason, they never did make decision on my case. This court was sending back to this court, and so finally Mr. Stevenson said, listen, we're going to take your case to the United States Supreme Court. And he explained to me that if the United States Supreme Court ruled against me within 2 years, and I'm going to be perfectly honest with you again, even him telling me within 2 years the state of Alabama would kill you, I was okay with that for one reason. The love of my life was no longer in this world, my mother. And I didn't see myself being in this world without my mother. And so I was okay with it. And I knew that if I die, I would be dying for something that I didn't do. And so when he took my case to the United States Supreme Court, all nine justices ruled in my favor. That my lawyer was ineffective. And we brought the case back to Alabama and
got a new trial.
And I didn't need it because the state of Alabama finally admitted that the bullets didn't match. They knew 30 years ago that those bullets didn't match. And I often tell people, the state of Alabama had every intention to execute me, but for two things they didn't foresee. The state of Alabama didn't know that I had a personal relationship with God. And the state of Alabama didn't know that God was going to send me his best attorney. And when they realized that they had to go up against God's best attorney, they said, we can't lie no more. We got to go on and release this man. And that's what they did.
So Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative is the reason you're sitting here today, and he's the reason why actually quite a large number of people who have been exonerated. And, you know, these are people who are doing tireless work as a nonprofit independent institution. They're not doing this on the behalf of the U.S. government. They're doing it because they feel that it's absolutely important to do it. So his name, Brian Stevenson's name, was, you mentioned in your book, was sort of known within the prison walls that if you were so lucky, you would have him as your attorney. He has a reputation behind bars.
He does. And I had never heard of Brian Stevenson until I went to death row. And in my book, I even tell guys, I said, man, you need Brian Stevenson. I kept saying, I got a lawyer. Yeah. And I kept asking, who is this Brian Stevenson that everybody keep bragging about? Man, I have a lawyer. And so I was hoping that my lawyer was doing what they needed to do. And as I tell in the book, they didn't. And then I finally.
And they wanted lots of money.
Oh, yes. Oh, you know, I had to tell one attorney, I'm in here for accused of stealing money, not in here for having money. Somehow you got it twisted. I'm not in them for having money, but I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Not only did Brian Stevenson become my lawyer, he became my friend. He is my hero for real. And not just my hero for what he done for me, but what he have done for countless other men and women throughout the prison system that is there for a crime they didn't commit. And for those that he been able to get out because of the judge over sentencing people. We have a bad problem in this country with the judicial system, and we need to face it. We need to get together and talk about what makes sense in this country.
So you were finally released after your after getting your new trial. Your mother was no longer there, but Lester was, your best friend, who stuck with you loyally through all these years. What was that moment like for you?
Oh, to finally be able to hug him and know that we was going to ride together and we was going to laugh and we didn't have to say visit now, it was over with, was more than I could ever imagine. And Lester had, when I got out, that's who I lived with until I was able to get a place of my own. And him and his wife was, it's like family. I don't look at him no other way but family. And I never will forget the first night I stayed, and his bed was so soft. And when he went to bed, I tried to lay in the bed, and my heart rate just went through the roof. And I remember saying, God, I know you didn't bring me this far to let me die of a heart attack. And so I had to go in the bathroom, something that was small, in order for me to sleep the first couple nights that
I was. Too much space, you weren't used to that?
Yes. And I slept on the floor in his bathroom. And I needed to tell him, because it would have bothering him. He would have probably tried to sit up all night and talk with me. I mean, I didn't want him to worry, but I loved him that much that I didn't want to bother him with what I was going through. I can't even put into words how thankful I am that I have a friend like that.
You lost 30 years of your life, nearly 30 years of your life. And it's not just you, your mother, your community. Can the state ever compensate you for it? And have they ever compensated you, even in the smallest way, for it?
No, the state of Alabama, yesterday was 3 years of being free. 3 years.
It was April 2015 that you were released.
Yes, on actually Good Friday, but it was the fifth when I first got out. The state of Alabama haven't even had the decency to say we're sorry. And I've been trying to file the paperwork to get compensated for my 30 years of wrongful conviction. The first year I filed, went through a committee, they voted 11-0 that I should be compensated. I never did get it. The second year, which was last year, they decided that I wasn't eligible for it because I didn't prove my innocence. And so I haven't got a dime from the state, no apology. And often I tell people, if they gave me $1 million for every year I was there, it still won't give me back what I lost. And so I think if the state of Alabama gave me $1.5 million, they're getting off easy. I mean, compared to what I feel I lost the time with my mother. To this day, I didn't get a chance to say goodbye proper like most people do with their loved one. And I have to live with that every day of my life, that knowing that I didn't get a chance to say bye, Mama. And that really bothers me every day, that I didn't get a chance to say bye, and I wasn't there for her when she needed me the most, when she was sick. And so whether I ever get it, to be honest with you, I don't think so. But I have to try to keep on going and doing what I need to do. I want to bring an end to the death penalty. I don't want no other man or woman to go through what I went through.
How do you put into context the larger political context that we find ourselves in today, what happened to you? How do you place your personal experience with this ongoing racism in our country, not just in the criminal justice system, but in contexts where police are present, the kind of language that's somehow become acceptable in public discourse once more? You know, that this country has never truly dealt with its legacy of racism.
Well, you know, that's the problem. If you don't deal with it, it always gonna linger. I think this country need a live, open debate about racism. I think young people need to know exactly the history of this country. I think people need to know that African-American didn't come to this country free will.
It's not an immigration story.
Oh, absolutely. We was kidnapped. Our ancestor was kidnapped and forced to come over here. And all of a sudden, sometimes it bothers me when I hear someone in the South holler, go back to Africa. And I'm saying, now that's one dumb person right there because he don't know his history. I didn't come over here volunteer. If anything, your ancestor need to be charged with kidnap. But until we sit down as men and women and have an open discussion about race, we're going to continue to have these problems. And I often tell people, my brothers, my father, my uncles, they died for this country as well. Blood and sweat, they helped build this country. And then you have people treat you as third-class citizens. We need an open debate, and we need an honest debate about race. And just like my friend in that book, Henry Hayes, I asked him, why do you hate me? And he went to say, well, blacks, I didn't ask you about blacks. I asked you why you hate me, because I knew I had never done anything to him, and I knew I didn't know him, he didn't know me. And finally he realized that I hadn't done anything to him. And I just think we need to get over this legacy of teaching our children about how to be racist and learning about love and caring for one another. I mean, we all in this country together. There's enough room in here for all of us. I don't understand, I guess, but to be honest with you, if you don't love yourself, then you don't have no anything else to do but hate someone else.
Are you heartened by the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the young activists that are continuing the struggle for racial justice?
I am, but see, with you know, when people ask me about Black Lives Matter, all lives matter to me. And I often would love to tell my black brothers and sisters this. Don't take to the streets and don't burn. Take that anger to the ballot box. That's where you need it at. Because you're playing into the hands when you put them in. And, you know, I'm so blessed to be able to get my voting rights back. And every time I vote.
So that was restored to you.
Yes. And that's what I wanted them to do. Let's march to the ballot box. And let's put people in there that are going to do the best for everybody. Not just for a few. And that's where you take that anger inside that booth. And pull that level.
And to their credit, there has been some electoral activism around Black Lives Matter getting in racial justice-minded DAs into office, which is, of course, has real-world implications. Still doesn't stop a bullet from hitting you from a cop's gun, unfortunately.
No. And you know, that's the thing, and that's what I'm saying about putting the right people in office. Because let's say you're a police chief, and one of your officers shoot just like up here in Sacramento. How you explain a man being shot 6 times in the back? Let's take a crate for apple. Is one of them is bad? We need to remove that bad one so we can save the other 23. And I just think when you got police chief and you got commissioner and you got prosecutors and judges and all this is upholding what they did, it only make it worse. And that's why I said we need to put the right people in office. And that way we won't be having these problems. When a police go out there and kill someone unarmed, we don't have to worry about someone coming to his defense and say, my officer shot in self-defense, because we want someone in office that's going to say, hey, you go out there, you protect yourself, but you go out there and you do something that you know is wrong. You don't have my back. That was the type of police chief we need in this country. And we need to sit down and have a honest debate why black men are being shot down at the rate that they are being. To me, this is an epidemic, and we need to do something about it.
So all the way from the first encounter with a police officer to the death penalty, our entire criminal justice system unfortunately remains racist and needs to be reformed. And I'm assuming you're going to spend the rest of your time, your newfound freedom, not so new anymore, you've been out for a few years, working to make that happen, which is quite remarkable. So
I am. I'm going to do everything I can. And as I said, I truly don't want this to happen, what happened to me, to anyone. It's a miscarriage of justice. It's not what justice should be about. And justice should be colorblind. But I often tell people, she can see. She might have this rag around her eyes, and she want to fool you that she can't see, but she can see. She know what gender you are. She know what state you live in. She know what college you went to. She know where, how much money you have in the bank. She know everything she need to know about you. And when you find yourself in her courtroom, she have already put all of those things together, and she have already determined whether you're going to be found innocent or guilty. That's a fact. And so we need to change that. And I'm asking every man, every woman, every boy, every girl that have a voice, lift your voice up. Let's come together and make this, overhaul this justice system where it need to be.
Anthony Ray Hinton, thank you so much for spending this time with us and sharing your story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Anthony Ray Hinton, a man who spent nearly 30 years on death row for crimes he did not commit. He was released in April 2015, and we've been discussing his new book, The Sun Does Shine, How I Found Life and Freedom on Death Row. He wrote it with Lara Love Hardin, and the book has a foreword by Brian Stevenson, the attorney who worked to prove his innocence. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find out more about us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.